Let's get this show on the road.
Commanding you to bow down.
I'm on your side.
By branding you as a rebel.
But you're not.
A traitor.
This isn't freedom. This is fear.
Are not the government. The government is not us.
This is the Files.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode number 45. Of the Dino Files show. I'm very happy to be doing this show today because, oh my god, is there so much news. It is amazing. There is an incredible amount of news. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. There are, developments on older stories. I'm pretty much, the last half of the show is kind of going to be an addendum to, maybe not half, but it's going to be an addendum to last week's show, where I believe last week I talked about the firing of James Gunn. Well, shit, of course, keeps churning in that department, and I also just finished So You've Been Publicly Shamed day before yesterday. That would have been Friday. I finished up that book on Friday. I listened to that whole book in one day because it is amazing. Typically, when I get home, I turn off shows and you know, I just listen to podcasts and books and stuff during work, but when I got home, I could not turn that show off, or that book off, rather. So I did that whole thing. I have a lot of clips to make of it, and I'm going to be releasing a show that's kind of a pseudo-review of that book in the coming weeks, and not in place of regular shows, in addition to regular shows. That book is amazing, and if I could sell that book in a package, I think about this a lot. If I ran a used bookstore, I would have a whole section that is just like two or three books, maybe four books, saran wrapped together, just like, this is a package about this thing, and if you want to learn about this thing, here are two or three books that you can read, and you will come out of it knowing a lot about this thing. And if I could wrap up So You've Been Publicly Shamed with The Kindly Inquisitors, which I need to listen to again, and I actually think a new edition came out, so I might actually need to read the hard copy, because my audiobook is going to be the previous edition. But, if I could wrap up those two books and sell those books in a package, I would absolutely do that. I would do the same thing with Kant's various ethical writings and Simone de Beauvoir. I would wrap those two things up and sell those as a package. I have all these packages that I would like to sell, but can't and won't. My audio quality might be bad. I didn't put up all the little padded dividers that I've got. Regardless, first thing we're going to look at today, on this wonderful day, we're going to be looking at interesting legislation. This bill was just submitted. This was submitted on August 3rd. So this was submitted on Friday. Which means, I don't even know if it's going to come up for a vote. It might not even come up for a vote. But it's interesting that it was submitted. This is a joint resolution. House Joint Resolution 138. 138. And it was submitted by, let me look real quick, Representative Grace Meng, Democrat from New York. And she submitted this bill proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the United States extending the right to vote to citizens 16 years of age or older. Section 1, the 26th article of amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed. Section 2, the right of citizens of the United States who are 16 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of age, Section 3. The Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. That's the totality of the... I mean, there's a whole section. I'll just read the whole thing. There's another section here below the title. Resolved by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America and Congress, assembled two-thirds of each house concurring therein, that the following article is proposed as an amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years after the date of its submission for ratification. So this is basically just an amendment. Very simple amendment structure. This is the kind of bill that I like reading because it's literally three sections and it's just an amendment. A lot of times you'll get bills that are proposed amendments that they'll go in and they basically pick the Constitution apart in interesting ways because the Constitution has overlaps in it in some areas where something will be mentioned in a couple of places and you have to go back and repeal the things that are happening in all of those places and replace them with different language. That's how an amendment works. And so if you actually read the Constitution and all of the amendments, it's kind of interesting the way that they do that. The one that sticks out to me the most is the amendment, and I can't remember which amendment it is, but the amendment that makes it so that the states no longer send the senators, that the senators are voted for by the citizens of the state. That wasn't always the case. That was an amendment to the Constitution. And when I was first sort of reading the Constitution and first getting into that, I think I was in high school. I was probably a freshman or a sophomore in high school, maybe. And I was reading the Constitution, and I read the part about where senators come from, basically. And I said, that's not how that works at all. So I kept reading and eventually read through all the amendments, and there it was in the amendment that that change was made. So it's a very interesting thing, the way that amendments work, and this is a very interesting bill because 16-year-olds voting? Interesting thought, I suppose. it's weird. I don't know, man. At that point, you would be able to vote long before you can drink, long before you can smoke weed in several states, long before you can smoke anything. I don't know, man. our concept of what makes a person able to do certain things is so arbitrary. In the United States specifically, it's very arbitrary. Like you can go die at the behest of a politician when you're 18 years old, 16 years old if you have parental consent, but you can't drink. It's odd. You can drive at 16, but you can't vote or drink or smoke. I don't know. It's pretty arbitrary, really, when you actually get into it. But we're going to move on from there. We're going to talk about an interesting article. There are a couple. There's a couple of interesting articles here today. I usually just do one. One from Quillit, which I like to do. There was one that was published today, the 5th, on Quillit. The Infantilization of Black America by Tosin Akintola. Very interesting article. I definitely recommend you go read it. I'm going to read the first paragraph from the article. In contemporary political discourse, Black America often seems to be perceived as a monolith. We are expected to think, act, and vote as one, and any attempt to step outside the bounds of our predetermined spectrum of thoughts can lead to summary excommunication. Our diversity pertains to our race, ethnicity, gender orientation, or sexual preference when we set against the rest of the American population, but the diversity of opinions, beliefs, and values found among American Blacks is seldom acknowledged. Even though the Black community in America includes immigrants from Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America, as well as multiracial individuals and descendants of the slave trade, we are often grouped together as one large, indistinguishable ideological block. I'm going to read the next one as well. Consider the recent criticism heaped on Dallas Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott. Prescott committed the apparently unpardonable sin of saying that he doesn't agree with the NFL players who chose to protest police violence by taking a knee during the national anthem. Speaking to reporters, Prescott said, I never protest during the anthem, and I don't think it's the time or the venue to do so. The game of football has always brought me such a piece, and I think it does the same for a lot of other people. People playing the game, people watching the game, and any people that have had an impact on the game, and that it goes on from there. But this is a very interesting article written by a black man, and it's and I have to point that out, because if it's written by a white dude, it automatically wouldn't matter. Because your, again, opinions are based on your race, or the value of those opinions, anyway. Second interesting article from The Guardian. This headline is, "My Son Osama, the Al-Qaeda Leader's Mother Speaks for the First Time." The subhead, nearly 17 years since 9/11, Osama bin Laden's family remains an influential part of Saudi society, as well as a reminder of the darkest moment in the kingdom's history. Can they escape his legacy? By Martin Chuloff. Now, this is a really good piece. This is, if you're a person who likes good journalistic writing, this is an example of really, really good journalistic writing. This is also relatively long, an interview with Osama bin Laden's mom. It's just interesting on every level. As an example of kind of how the writing is, it's excellent sort of a feature style journalistic writing. From the story, "On the corner of a couch of a spacious room, a woman wearing a brightly patterned robe sits expectantly. The red hijab that covers her hair is reflected in a glass-fronted cabinet. Inside, a framed photograph of her firstborn son takes pride of place between family heirlooms and valuables. A smiling, bearded figure wearing a military jacket, he features in photographs around the room, propped against the wall at her feet, resting on a mantelpiece. A supper of Saudi maize and a lemon cheesecake has been spread out on a large wooden dining table." That's just the very first paragraph. Excellent scene setting. And that continues. Like, that kind of writing continues through the whole story. It's really, really good stuff. Fuck, this is... it's incredible. I just can't get over how cool this piece is. Props to The Guardian for publishing something this cool. If you are more conspiratorial in your thinking, as I can be sometimes, go ahead and give it a read and dig through and see if you can find anything there. It's kind of fascinating. She does seem to think, I will tell you this, she does seem to think that Osama was kind of brainwashed while he was at university in Saudi Arabia. She does seem to think that he was sort of brainwashed by the Muslim Brotherhood while he was in school. And one of the things that I don't think is mentioned in the article as much is that two of her other sons were there in the room during this, and the author said that they seemed pretty adamant that his path was his own, that he wasn't forced to do a goddamn thing. They might actually hold a little bit of animosity toward him, as they probably should. We're going to move on, and we're going to start the news, but go ahead and read those two articles. "The Infantilization of Black America on Quillet" by Tosin Akintola, and "My Son Osama" by Martin Chulov from The Guardian. It is just, wow. Two really good pieces. Really, really good pieces. But we're going to move on. We're going to talk about Harvard study, "Trigger warnings may impede resilience," from thefire.org by Cynthia Myersberg. "A soon-to-be-published study presents compelling new findings regarding the impact of trigger warnings. In this study, trauma-naive participants who had not experienced traumatic events such as rape, warfare, or natural disasters were randomly assigned to either receive a trigger warning or not receive a trigger warning before reading potentially distressing literary passages. As a group, the participants who received trigger warnings perceived increased emotional vulnerability to trauma and also increased belief that trauma survivors are vulnerable. In addition, trigger warnings increased anxiety for those participants who strongly believe that words can cause harm." Quote, "Trigger warning, empirical evidence ahead," by Benjamin W. Bellett, Peyton J. Jones, and Richard J. McNally of Harvard University, will appear in the forthcoming issue of the Journal of Behavior Therapy and Experimental Psychiatry. "A trigger warning is, quote, a statement cautioning that content, as in a text, as in text, video, or class, may be disturbing or upsetting, end quote. They are now used in many college classrooms. Experts disagree as to whether trigger warnings are beneficial, harmful, or both beneficial and harmful, yet there has been little research regarding their use. The researchers here were concerned that trigger warnings may be harmful for the majority of students who have not yet experienced a major trauma but will encounter one later in life. Whether a person is likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, owes to a number of factors, including the severity and type of trauma experienced, as well as additional factors which can either place persons at increased risk or offer increased protection. In the end, although a vast majority of people will experience trauma in their lives, only a small percentage will go on to develop PTSD. One concern over the use of trigger warnings in light of this is that they may... I don't like the way that she inserts comma-separated performatives kind of into the pieces. It's the style. It's her style. It's fine. In light of this, is that they may unintentionally deliver the message that lasting, debilitating post-traumatic stress... post-traumatic symptoms are a normal response to trauma, when in fact they are not, and that being a trauma survivor necessarily becomes a central aspect of one's identity. This matters because how people frame their experiences and what they expect their outcomes to be, so-called expectancy effects, impacts how resilient or vulnerable people are when they actually encounter the challenge of recovering from traumas. This is fascinating and unsurprising. We found, at least I've seen, and this is zero data, but in my experience, I've seen over time an increase in the number of people who claim that they have some surviving trauma or some surviving, they kind of, in a sense, claim PTSD based on some factor that I think if 20 years ago you said caused PTSD, you would be laughed out of a room. Like, people who claim PTSD just because they're a woman, right, in the world, just existing, which you do see in some places, albeit rare, and again, without any real viability, but people do kind of act like this. I've seen it more and more, and I've got no data to support this, but I think other people have probably seen it as well. I think this kind of, while it's probably a respectful thing to, in a context where people would not expect heavy topics, I think it's probably respectful to let people know that a heavy topic is going to come up, right? Like, not this show. This show, and anybody who listens to the show knows that I hit heavy topics periodically, and that I tend to take some news stories relatively personally, and I touch on heavy shit. And anyone who's heard the show more than once knows that. So I don't feel like it's necessary for me, but like if I were making a music podcast, I've done a few different like music shows before. If I were making a music podcast and I were to bring up something heavy, I would probably warn somebody ahead of time that something heavy was going to come up, just because I think it's probably a respectful thing to do. But there's this overwhelming notion socially that this is the kind of thing that has to happen everywhere, all the time, and at all times. That if anything controversial or heavy is going to come up, you need to warn people. And I don't think that's accurate. And I think this Harvard study might kind of explain why. I don't believe that encouraging softness in people is a good idea. For the reason that this study might seem to support, that if you are under the impression that the right way to respond to trauma or what have you is to be hurt by it, I don't know. There's a sense of weakness that comes with that, I think. That's not safe. And I say not safe very specifically because I can tell you and I've mentioned this on the show before with reference to my personal experiences. I have been physically accosted for years of my life by peers. Not at home. My parents are incredible. and not by my siblings or anything. My brother's awesome. But at school, I was bullied for years and years, and it got physical. It got to the point that I was being kicked while I was on the ground. Like, these things did happen to me. And I don't feel like they define me. But we seem to be building a sort of society where that kind of thing should define you. Or where people are being told, or that they're under the impression that that kind of thing should define them. And I find that dangerous. I think there's no way that's healthy. There can be no way that that's healthy. I don't know. I don't like it. I'm against it. Next story from CNN Politics. Okay, AOC. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I haven't talked about her really yet. I don't know if I'm going to. She's basically young chick Bernie. I mean, really? And I've shit on Bernie quite a bit on this show. And basically, if you copy-pasted everything I've said about Bernie Sanders, you could just copy-paste it onto Ocasio-Cortez, and I have the same problems. But this is a story from CNN Politics. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won in New York. Now her allies are taking on the Midwest. This was published August the 2nd. Written by Gregory Creek. So, consider Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's travel schedule. Over the past 2 weeks, the aggressive new voice of the progressive left has crisscrossed the Midwest, making a stop in Kansas to campaign alongside Bernie Sanders, as well as solo trips to Missouri and Michigan to stump for insurgent candidates hoping to follow in her path. That Ocasio-Cortez consistently finds herself hundreds of miles from the Bronx and Queens, where in June she stunned the political world by unseating the fourth-ranking Democrat in the House, shows just how important the next several weeks are for the movement she has come to represent. Beginning with contests in those three states on August 7th and continuing on for nearly five consecutive weeks after that, progressive outsiders will test their mettle against establishment Democrats in elections from Hawaii to Delaware and Massachusetts. Success in many of these races has the potential to not only shape the 2018 field, but embolden a future crop of progressives, and signal a shift further to the left within the Democratic Party. On the flip side, a shutout would stifle, or at least put on hold, any suggestion that the party's moderates are facing an existential threat from their left flank. Campaigning for Michigan's Abdul El-Sayed, who is vying against the odds of conventional wisdom to become the country's first Muslim governor, Ocasio-Cortez explained the core electoral assumption underlying the movement. Quote, "Our swing voter is not red to blue," she said at a stop in Flint. "Our swing voter is the voter to non-voter, the non-voter to voter." In an interview later, she all but dismissed the existence of a persuadable center. Quote, "I don't think that swing voters decide based on how much a candidate has run to the middle the most," Ocasio-Cortez said. "I know people who are swing voters, and when I think about how they decide, they don't say, oh, I'm voting for this person because they became the most Republican out of the whole race to earn my vote. Expanding the electorate is the path." So, the way that she sees it, the people who are going to elect socialists, because that's what she fucking is, she doesn't claim the title, but she's a goddamn socialist, just like Bernie's a goddamn socialist. The people who are going to elect these people are non-voters, people who abstain. It's a fascinating take because, it's probably true, first off. I don't think centrists in the United States are responsive to people who have been endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America. I don't think that's their, I don't think that's how they're gonna go. But I can say that if you have people who are socialists or even communists, because I do know that there are many communists in the United States who are big fans of all these socialists who are coming up. That seems to be the way that people are reacting, at least on social media, which again, no data, but I think it's probably a fair assessment. I don't know. Voters who abstain are hard to get to vote. That's. I'm not sure if this is a good strategy or not. It might be the only strategy, but I don't know if it's a good one because again, voters who abstain are really difficult to get to go out and vote. They either hate everyone who's running and have no interest, or they don't think it's important, or they don't think that their voice matters, which doesn't. But it's one of these things that, I don't know. It's an interesting strategy. It's a bold move, Cotton. Let's see if it works. I'm interested to see. By the way, yeah, I'm one of these people who think that the future of the Democratic Party is socialism. I really do believe that. Establishment Democrats are the people who ran Hillary Clinton. And whether you liked Hillary Clinton or not, no, I'm not going to say that. Whether you are a Republican or not, or a Democrat or not, you have to admit that Hillary Clinton was the worst possible choice. She's fucking garbage. She is not a good candidate. I don't think she ever was. But it was establishment Democrats who picked her. In fact, they stacked the deck against Bernie to make sure she got the nomination. And we know this from the emails that leaked. So, I really do think that establishment Democrats are in a rough position. I think the future of the Democratic Party is going to have to be pushing further left, which is probably good for the Republicans. Because if the Republicans are smart, they'll push toward the center. If the Republicans are smart, they will become much more liberal on social issues moving forward. If the Republicans are smart, they're going to start running people who don't give a shit if you're gay or not. Who fucking cares? Not the point. I think if the Republicans can co-opt a little bit of, a little bit of libertarianism, I think they can probably push toward the center enough to actually pick up most of the swing votes. Because again, if the Democrats are going to be depending on non-voters to vote, that's a harder row to hoe than getting people in the middle to vote for you. So I think smart money, I think, if you're a Republican, is on going more liberal socially. Dropping the drug war, dropping the war on sex work, dropping the war on porn, dropping the religious moralism, all of that. Let it go and become a purely economic party. I think that would be their best way forward. I don't think they'll do it for two reasons. I think the first reason they won't do it is because there are two kinds of establishment Republican. There are neocons, neoconservatives, just people who just really, they just love war. And they'll do whatever they have to do to make sure war happens. People like John McCain. And then you also have establishment Republicans who are establishment Republicans in the sort of moralist, Reaganite sort of sense. Both of those things exist as, you know, elder statesmen of the Republican Party. And if they have anything to say about it, the social liberalism won't happen. I think Republicans are probably going to hold the line. Just be kind of how they've always been. Or Trump was a wake-up call. I don't know. There's so many moving parts, especially to the Republicans. The Democrats is fairly simple. With the Democrats, you've got your Reagan-era Democrats as part of your establishment, and you have your hardline Democrats who are pseudo-socialists, but not really, and not big fans of war, kind of peaceniks. And then you have people who are the insurgent wing of the Democratic Party, people like Ocasio-Cortez, the socialists. They're a pretty simple mix. The Republicans, because of all of the other interests involved in the Republican Party, things like, you know, neocons, and the interests that they serve, and then you also have Trump, which is just a really, really a wrench in the works on a lot of levels for the Republicans. The Republicans used to be a little bit more complex when you had the Tea Party happening, but that didn't work. But I think the DSA has a good chance of taking over the Democratic Party if the, again, establishment Democrats are, if they don't have the reins on the party. Kind of like how the Republicans lost the reins. How the establishment Republicans lost the reins when Trump got elected. I don't know. It's very interesting. The midterms are going to be really interesting. And beyond that, 2020 is going to be fascinating. I know a lot of you who listen are anarchists or libertarians, and you don't really care about politics as politics, right? But this is one of the things that I love. This is one of the things that got me into thinking politically, is just the way that parties work and the way that these people think and sort of all of the forces that are pulling on opinion in different directions and trying to make sense of those things. So I'm going to be fascinated to see what happens in the midterms. I'm going to be even more interested to see what happens in 2020. One of the things I'm really interested to see that we need to look out for, too, in 2020, just by the by. Can you hear my cat? I can hear my cat. One of the things that I'm really interested to see in 2020 is whether the Republicans run someone against Trump. I think, depending upon the way that the midterms go, that could be a good thing to do or a stupid thing to do. If the blue wave happens, it would be stupid. Because if you have enough Democrats who are fired up that they're able to flip the House, and that's all they really need is to flip the House. I don't know if they're going to flip the Senate or not. I doubt it. But if you have enough Democrats who are fired up to go flip the House in a midterm, you would be stupid to muddy your own waters in the presidential election in the following 2 years. That would be, I think, a massive mistake. If the blue wave doesn't happen, though, you might have a chance to clean up Trump. And there's a lot of Republicans, not just establishment guys, there are a lot of Republicans who really hate Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump's not a Republican. So I'm very interested to see how the Republicans handle this thing. The Democrats, I think it's just going to be a slow slide towards socialism. I don't find it interesting because I think I kind of know where it's going. All right. I'll do it this way. This is how I'll do this. I know how I'm going to handle this. I'm going to read another piece, and then we're going to get into the next topic. This is from Twitchy, posted on July the 20th. Flashback, James Gunn endorsed advertiser boycott of Laura Ingraham. From the story, it's not just Roseanne Barr who writer-director James Gunn thought should be fired. Check out what he had to say about Fox News' Laura Ingraham. And then there's an embedded tweet from James Gunn, who says, I'm really looking forward to season 2 of Handmaid's Tale, so I hope Hulu stops advertising on Aunt Linda's show. On the Laura Ingraham show, so I can watch it. Online bullying and shaming of teenagers should not be supported by Hulu. Let them know. Back to the story. That mob doesn't look so good when it's heading your direction, does it? It gets worse. Gunn defended Laura Ingraham losing her show because Fox News would just replace it with something else so nobody would lose their jobs. Somebody replied to James Gunn, so you're upset. In your opinion, Trump tried to take down the NFL, but you're not upset that people try to take down Ingraham or other persons / businesses. And James Gunn replies, A, he's the freaking president of the United States. One of his jobs is to facilitate the economy. B, if Ingram's show is canceled, it's replaced by another, an equal amount of jobs. It's not an overall loss, as is the NFL. C, do I really have to explain all this? Okay, fine. But that's just a throwback to, the way that things have been going. Before we get into our main topic, you know what time it is. I know what time it is. It is time.
Credits will do fine.
It's time for Who Do You Trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
Who do you trust? Credits will do fine. This is the credits segment of the show. This is the part of the show where I call out the wonderful, wonderful people who give a little bit of coin, a little scratch for what I do here and the people who help make this thing possible. I'll tell you, if this kind of thing weren't a possibility, I probably wouldn't be doing this show. But because of leaders like Adam Curry and John Dvorak and people like that who have set up the possibility of a donation-supported podcast model. I am sort of fired up to never take ads, never do any of this stuff on alternative internet radio and on this show specifically. And so for keeping the faith, I need to thank Max Ogburn. On Max Ogburn on Patreon gives $5, and I'm so thankful for that. Max Ogburn, you're a god among men. And if you would like to donate to the show, there's a page on Alternative Internet Radio, ARD.io, and on The Rogue File. If you'd like to be called out like wonderful Mr. Max, you can do that. And there are also other things there as well. And there's also merch. I always forget to mention the different ways to donate. So all of that exists. And again, thanks a million, Mr. Max Ogburn. You are wolf amongst ravens. That's a phrase that exists, and I'm not entirely sure what it means. All right. I will eventually make a sounder to leave the credits segment because it sounds awkward trying to leave the credits segment. But let's get into our main topic for today. So I talked about the James Gunn situation in the last episode, and I'm not going to reiterate my thoughts on that, but what I will say is that these things have continued. These kinds of situations. From the National Review, published August 2nd, newest member of the New York Times editorial board has a history of racist tweets. Sarah Jeong, who will be joining the New York Times editorial board in September, has expressed open disdain for white people in numerous tweets sent between 2013 and 2015. Jeong's Twitter account is replete with racial insults against white people, whom she has described as groveling goblins, bullshit, miserable, and dogs. Dumbass fucking white, quote, dumbass fucking white people marking up the internet with their opinions like dogs pissing on fire hydrants, end quote. Jeong wrote in November 2014, quote, are white people genetically predisposed to burn faster in the sun, thus logically being the only fit to live underground like groveling goblins? She wrote a month later. Jeong, who was hired Wednesday as the Times lead editorial writer on technology, by the way, she's a fucking shit tech writer. I went back and looked at some of her stuff and some of the videos that she's done. She's the kind of tech journalist that I fucking hate. And by that, I mean she doesn't know a goddamn thing about the technology. She thinks the internet is Google and Twitter. Like, that's her take. Oh, I hate that kind of shit. It makes me angry. She attended Harvard Law School and has previously written for The Atlantic, Motherboard, and Washington Post, and The New York Times Magazine. Jeong's comments, which have drawn considerable backlash among fellow journalists on Twitter, emerged months after The Times fired another new hire, Quinn Norton, over racist and anti-gay language in her old tweets. Just hours after hiring Norton as their tech writer, The Times revoked the offer, claiming it was initially unaware of the tweets. So, I'm going to look at some of the tweets that were there. Let's go back. I'm just going to read off some of these. Here's one. Oh man, it's kind of sick how much joy I get out of being cruel to old white men. Different one. I dare you to get on Wikipedia and play things white people can definitely take credit for. It's really hard. Other one. One, white men are bullshit. Two, no one cares about women. Three, you can threaten anyone on the internet except cops. Another one. I just realized why I can't stand watching Breaking Bad or Battlestar Galactica. The premise of both is just white people being miserable. Which is very interesting because it's not, I mean, okay, anyway. Battlestar fucking rocks and she needs to shut the fuck up. another one. At Rep Dan Mode, white people have stopped breeding. You'll all go extinct soon. This was my plan all along. Devilish face. Another one. Hashtag cancel white people. There's a whole string. She's fucking stupid. Which is obvious, but she got mobbed. She got mobbed for this. Anyway, yeah, I'm just gonna keep going. She got mobbed for this. People were calling for her to be fired, calling for the job offer to be revoked, all this other stuff. People on the right specifically, and you know, whatever. This is what is happening. The only reason I talk about this is just to get to this point. this world, I said I've been reading So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and I finished the book, and it is amazing, and everyone should read it. This world has existed for a long time, and it started this idea of the mob getting people fired, burning down people's lives, attacking people online, all this other stuff. This idea started, I think, specifically from the left. I don't think that you can make a good case that Republicans, really, I guess, did this before progressives did. And I say progressives specifically because that's who it is. It's social justice warrior progressives. Normal, average, run-of-the-mill Democrats didn't do it. It was progressives. And I don't like using that word. It feels buzz-phrasy and shitty, but that's what it is. I mean, that's the truth. So all of this started there, and all of this started with just outrage mobbing, specifically on Twitter, and you know, the biggest example of it, especially in the early days of this kind of thing, was Justine Sacco. Justine Sacco, who basically had her life burned down while she was on an 11-hour flight. She tweeted before she left, she tweeted an AIDS joke. And then when she landed, she'd lost her job, she had lost her whole life. Everything was burned down. Because the mob had surrounded that. She had like 100 followers at the time. It's not like she had 10,000 followers on Twitter when she tweeted that. It's like 100 people. And her life got burned down for it. For a joke. And I don't care. I'll tell you what arguments mean nothing to me. And these are arguments that were made about James Gunn, too. The arguments that mean nothing to me are, well, if she's not a comedian, then she shouldn't be making jokes like that. Fuck you. People get to make jokes. If you're sitting around at the bar with your buddies, you get to make a joke. You don't have to be a fucking comedian to make a joke. And I extended that further than a lot of people do. I extend that and I say, you know what? If you think it's funny, say it. Maybe someone will laugh. Maybe someone will chide you and say, dude, that's not funny. Okay, fine. But that should be the extent of it. That should be the extent of it. I don't think you have to be a comedian to make a joke. People were saying this about James Gunn on the on Justin Robert Young's show. He had somebody write in and say, I don't think James Gunn's a comedian, so why is he trying to make jokes and be funny? Fuck you. I mean, first of all, how do you define comedian? If you're going to go down that road, then you have to be able to define when somebody becomes a comedian. Is it when they do one open mic night? Is it when they make money doing the job? Because there's a lot of comedians who make no fucking money being comedians. So how do you define a comedian? And if you're going to, for any one of those definitions that anyone's going to give me, I'm going to come up with a way to beat it. Because it's stupid. On its face, it's stupid. I've had people say, well, you can't call yourself a thing unless you're making money doing it. Okay, so people who don't make money doing their art, but they still do art, they're not artists? I mean, they are. I mean, you wouldn't logically say that someone's not an artist, especially if they're incredibly talented, just because they don't make money doing it. You just can't say that logically. So there's no way for me anyway. There's no way to make a case that a person shouldn't be allowed to say a thing because they are not this or that. I think that's dumb. So, and again, that's for people who are making that argument about James Gunn, too. People who wanted to see James Gunn get taken down. And that's all that really was anyway. Was just the James Gunn thing was backlash from the right for specifically for Roseanne, but also for the years and years that people have been having their lives burned down because of shit they said. And it being primarily people on the right or even centrists who have said these things. And it's primarily progressives who go after them, go after the advertisers, go after their employers, go after whatever. So people who think like I think, myself and many others with much larger followings and much bigger voices, But I'm proud to count myself among them. The free speech absolutists who say, no. You do not get to mob people because they said something you don't like. You don't get to utilize the power of you and your shitty friends with shitty opinions at mentioning an employer on Twitter all day long. That is not a legitimate form of discourse. It just isn't. If you have a problem with a thing, make it clear you have a problem with the thing. That's fine. But trying to ruin somebody's life because they said something you don't like, I think is inherently unethical. Now, if a person's employer saw a tweet that they made and said, I don't think I want to employ you based on this. I don't think that's okay. There would be, number one, there's two possibilities there. The first is that that person's going to have an opportunity to explain, to contextualize things. Most likely. And even if they don't, That's okay. Now, if an employer's getting mobbed online, or a company's getting mobbed, or someone's advertisers are getting called, and now they're locked. Now they are, it's like you're pinned in the octagon. You can't make a move except to fire the person. Even if you don't want to. That is inherently wrong. And I think this cuts both ways. Now, people who think like me, getting back onto that line because I abandoned that somewhere. People who think like I think, many people who are more influential and important than I am, have been saying to the left for years, this is not the world you want. Because if you think you are immune, you're crazy. I wrote about this on the Rogue File. I wrote a piece about the death of free expression. And that was the basis of the piece. Is that I know, number one, it matters to me because I know anarchists are on that line somewhere. And number two, maybe you are on that same list with me, just a little further down. And James Gunn learned he's on the same list. And Dan Harmon learned he's on the same list. And this woman now, too, Sarah Jeong, has learned she's on the same list. Because the mob is only a good thing when it's on your side. Now, I think, mathematically, then, that would prove that the mob is almost never a good thing. At least objectively. Because even if it's on your side, it's only good in a subjective way. Right? Now, there's a piece that was written on Hot Air about this. Posted on August 3rd. Headline, Sarah Jeong is a warning sign of something wrong with the left. And the piece reads, the more I think about it, the less I care about Sarah Jeong. I don't think I'd ever read anything she'd written before this week, and having now read a few things, I don't think I was missing all that much. That's not meant as a slam on her ability, because I think she's actually a good writer. You don't know much about fucking tech writing then. But the subject she writes about isn't that interesting to me. She styles herself as an expert on technology, which doesn't mean she could rebuild a V8 engine or repair a circuit board. In media parlance, it means she has opinions about social media, so whatever. I don't even care very much about her racist tweets per se, or even her lame excuse for making them. What does bother me is the way in which the left collectively responded to her tweets with a big shrug. Ed wrote earlier about the Washington Post piece, which wonders aloud whether Jeong did anything wrong. I read the same piece this morning, and this is the paragraph that stood out. Quote, without evidence that they had any bearing on Jeong's extensive body of work, which includes a book she wrote about online harassment, these statements could have perhaps been unceremoniously dismissed as insignificant. But after conservative media seized the story Thursday, they ignited a firestorm of debate, end quote. That really sums up what bothers me about this whole story. It's the assumption that a public comment like white men are bullshit would get a shrug if not for conservative seizing on it. It's an admission from the Post that there is almost nothing you can say about white men that anyone on the left would deem problematic, to borrow a popular SJW term of art. The reason why Jeong's tweets didn't really matter to anyone on the left is that they've nearly all accepted the idea that racism doesn't mean what most people think it means. Andrew Sullivan points out how the left has redefined it. Quote, the alternative view, that of today's political left, is that Jeong Oh, Zhang definitionally cannot be racist because she's both a woman and a racial minority. Racism is against whites in this neo-Marxist view. Racism against whites in this neo-Marxist view just, quote, isn't a thing. Just as misandry literally cannot exist at all. And this is because, in this paradigm, racism has nothing to do with a person's willingness to prejudge people by the color of their skin or to make broad, ugly generalizations about whole groups of people based on horror-y stereotypes. Rather, racism is entirely institutional and systematic, a function of power, and therefore it can only be expressed by the powerful, i.e., primarily white, straight men. For a non-white female like Sarah Zhang, it is simply impossible. In the religion of social constructionism, Zhang, by virtue of being an Asian woman, is one of the elect, incapable of the sin of racism or of group prejudice. End quote. Zhang was just exploring the space of this privileged position, secure that she could say just about anything without fear of blowback. Indeed, she had many defenders who refused to even acknowledge the possibility of another point of view about what she'd said. When you'd start from the premise that one group of people cannot be offended, you naturally wind up at the conclusion that anyone who says otherwise is being dishonest. Quote, the editors of The Verge, where Zhang still works, described any assertion of racism in Zhang's tweets as dishonest and outrageous, a function of bad faith and an attack on journalism itself. Scroll through left Twitter and you find utter incredulity that demonizing white people could in any way be offensive. That's the extent to which loathing and contempt for white people is now background noise on the left. Yes, we all live on campus now. The neo-Marxist analysis of society, in which we are all mere appendages of various groups of oppressors and oppressed, in which the oppressed definitionally cannot be at fault, is now the governing philosophy of almost all liberal media. That's how the Washington Post can provide a platform for raw misandry, and the New York Times can hire and defend someone who can express racial hatred. The great thing about being in the social justice movement is how liberating it can feel to give voice to incendiary, satisfying bigotry and know that you're still on the right side of history. End quote. That's what really bothers me about this. It's that one form of blatant bigotry gets a pass on the grounds that it will not really hurt anyone. If the left thinks that's true, I think they're not paying attention. Sarah Zhang isn't all that significant, but what this affair says about the left's mindset does matter. And that's that whole story. And I actually couldn't have said it better. I don't think I could have. It's what, again, people like me. I say that in a sense so that I don't seem like I'm trying to claim this perspective, the perspective of the free speech absolutist, because I'm not. I didn't come up with it. You know. Things like the Kindly Inquisitors and stuff like that, that all happened way before I was even of the mind to care about this kind of shit. But I find myself agreeing with that point of view of the free expression absolutist. And as much as I think it's ridiculous that Sarah Zhang could say this, I'm still of two minds about this. Just like I was last episode. One half of me says mobbing people for things they've said is wrong. And the other part of me, when it's a leftist, when it's a bigot like Sarah Zhang, says, this is the bed you fucking made. Lie in it. This is your doing. And we've been saying for years that it was going to come back on you, and you ignored us. You laughed. Well, how does it feel, James Gunn, Sarah Zhang, Dan Harmon? How does it fucking feel? That's not a very principled take. Which is why... that's why I don't think that side of me's right. I think that side of me is angry. And that's fine. I think the side of me that understands the principle says, hopes at least, that this will teach these people how wrong they've been. I hope that as the mob turns against the left, as people utilize the tactics of the left against the left will realize how wrong their tactics have been. I hope that will happen. I wish that these tactics were never used in the first place. I think that they are bad tactics. But again, there's that angry piece of me that sees it happening to someone on the left and says, fucking take it, bitch. Whether it's James Gunn or Dan Harmon or Sarah Jeong, there's that part of me that relishes this happening to the people who built the world that's now destroying them. I don't feel bad for feeling that way. I think it's probably a natural way for those of us in this position to feel. I think there's when our warnings about this get ignored, when I write a piece like The Death of Free Expression and people say that's fucking ridiculous or, you know, whatever, and then it comes back to bite them in the ass or to bite the people that they like in the ass, you kind of feel vindicated. But that still doesn't justify the tactic. It's still wrong. I really wish that there was a way to make it clear just how wrong it is without reverting to turning it against the people who did it in the first place. And I think turning it against the people who did it in the first place isn't going to work. I want to be clear about that too. I don't think this is an effective tactic. Just like I'm one of these people who sort of thinks that the progressives doing shit like this gave us Trump. I think when you turn this around, you're going to get another, the pendulum's going to swing again, right? So I don't think using this tactic on the left is going to be effective for what, you know, the Cernoviches of the world want it to do. I don't think they're ever going to realize that they've been wrong. And I don't want to sound like a Cernovich fanboy or defender either. I fucking hate Mike Cernovich. I just bring him up because he's the one that did the James Gunn thing. That was him. I think this piece kind of lays out that the people on the left are already in a mindset that nothing Sarah Jeong said was wrong. That bigotry cannot exist from women, especially women of color. They just can't possibly be bigoted. It isn't possible. We've already seen the left start narrowing this down as well. The number of pieces that have been written, or maybe it's just one piece that's been shared everywhere, but it seems to have some effect, is the piece that was written about how straight black men are the straight white men of black people. It's getting narrower and narrower, right? This is the inevitable conclusion of intersectionalism, is this idea that when you value this state of being stacked on this state of being stacked on this state of being, for example, being a person of color stacked on top of being a woman stacked on top of being a trans woman, right? That's the trifecta. You are the most oppressed, right? Like you win. When you value something like that, you kind of have to start narrowing down what the kinds of people that you're willing to value. It's like we've seen, again, with straight black men. They're out. They're out of the club. Because that's how intersectionalism works. Instead of seeing people as individuals, you see people as, okay, where are they in the Venn diagram? The Venn diagram that consists of, on the one part, gender, on the other part, race, and on the other part, LGBT. Those are the primary factors. If you're in the middle of that Venn diagram, you're the winner. And if you're on the outsides of those, well, you're being forgotten. You're being kicked out. So, I don't know. I'm saddened to see this expanding. I feel vindicated. Because I called it, and many others have called it, and people laughed. People thought it was stupid. Well, you made the bed. This is the world that you decided you wanted, against everyone who knew a goddamn thing, telling you that you don't want to build this world. You decided to build it, and now it's come back to bite you in the ass. Now, the New York Times has elected to stand behind Sarah Jeong, probably because they don't want the embarrassment of hiring two women in a row and having to immediately fire them because they're shitty fucking people. But the Times has decided to stand behind this particular hiring, which is upsetting on two levels because she's also a tech editor at the New York Times and doesn't know a goddamn thing about technology. As I said before, she thinks the internet is Twitter. If you asked her how does a VPN work, she wouldn't be able to answer the question. And a lot of people wouldn't be able to answer that question, and I don't hold that against anyone. I do hold it against someone who's a fucking technology editor at National Magazine, National Newspaper. I absolutely hold that shit against you. You're the technology editor, you should be able to at least explain to me how a VPN works. It's very basic. I don't expect everyone to know it, but if technology editor's on your video card, you sure as hell better. And I doubt she does. There's also a piece in the New York Post I was going to read called, We've Got to Step Letting Outrage Mobs Get People Fired. But, yeah, I'm not gonna get into it. It talks about Justine Sacco a little bit. I might get into it when I do the show about, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. I might get into it when I do that show. But I'm not going to right now. Because it's been over an hour. This is the first show that's gone over an hour that I've done in a very long time. So I'm weirdly proud of that and also a little sad because I know once you hit that 1 hour mark, some people get a little skeeved out. You come in at 40 minutes, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, people are typically pretty excited to listen, and then you break an hour and people really don't know what to say. Some people don't want to get into a thing if it says it's over 60 minutes, but I think it'll be fine. This is not the last that we're going to hear of this topic. As this continues to expand, I'm going to keep abreast of it, because this show has always had a focus on free expression. I'm not going to say has always, because that's not true. Since I've started doing the show in a more honest fashion, in a way that felt less like doing a show and more just like me talking about shit, this show has really kind of focused on free expression, and I think it's important to continue following this, and I really don't want to feel good about leftists being attacked by the mob. I don't feel good about it, I don't think, but there is that part of me, and as I know, there is that part of others who feels vindicated by it. Like, we said this was going to happen. You didn't believe us. Well, here you fucking go. So, we'll see. They're not going to learn anything from it. If I can pull out my crystal ball for a second, if I were to make a prediction, my prediction would be the left's not going to learn anything from it, and they're going to come back more furious than ever. In fact, if depending upon how this thing plays socially, this could contribute to a blue wave. That might be a little bit too close, but it might affect 2020, depending upon how this goes. Oh, God damn it. And of course, you know, as we like to say,
if you can't fix what's broken, you'll go insane.
And what's broken here is seeing people as a collective. Instead of viewing people as individuals, instead of viewing people as simply who they are, we're seeing people as a collective. The left sees white straight men as a collective, and so Sarah Jeong can get away with this because all white straight men are guilty of the crimes of white straight men of the past and all over the world, apparently. And as a woman of color, it's impossible that she's a bigot. It's not possible. It just isn't possible. I think that's part of the reason that James Gunn wasn't supported the way that she's been supported either. Is because James Gunn's a white dude. But I don't know. That's getting too much into trying to guess other people's motivations. That is really all I have to say for today. Like I said, this issue will come up again, and I did want to share this with you. Next time we have a story about a sex scandal, because I want to start. I don't want to start focusing on the Stormy Daniels thing, but when it comes back up in the news cycle, because this is one of those things that gets cycled out. The No Agenda Show has this thing they call the Trump Rotation, and it's a list of insults that seem to just get slotted in and exist for a week, and then come out and they slot another one in, and that exists for a week, and then they pull that one out and they slot another one in. And the next time the Stormy Daniels stuff comes around, I would like to play this because I thought it was hilarious. This is a clip from Vampire in Brooklyn.
Don't be ashamed because you went out and got your little ass.
Look out.
Ass is good.
That's right. Ass is good. I love it. Oh, that movie's funny. If you've never seen Vampire in Brooklyn, watch it. It's pretty funny. But that's all I have to say for today. Goodness gracious. Thank you guys so much for hanging out and for indulging me on this wonderful Sunday evening. I'll see ya. Remember, everybody, you can find me on Twitter at DinoFiles, no spaces, no dashes. You can find the network at AltNet Radio. You can find the show and other shows all get posted to Alternative Internet Radio, AIRAD.io. You can find the posts, the blog posts that correspond to this show at the Rogue File, roguefile.com. You can also donate to the show from there or from AIR. You can donate. You have many options for that. A lot of there's Patreon. There's also different versions of crypto you can donate. You can also get merch if you want something for your money. We have a merch store there as well. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank those of you who download to listen, those of you who stream live, and I want to thank those of you who rate and review us on iTunes or whatever platform. I want to thank those of you who hang out and chat and keep me on my toes during the show. You are all wonderful people, and you should all have a wonderful week.
This show is part of the Alternative Internet Radio Podcast Network. For more great shows like this, visit AIR at AIRAD.io.